God for being there in all of this, for all of us, wherever we are. I'd also like to not misrepresent Luke. He's taking this very seriously and he's in a meeting at the moment working on it, so it's significant to him. I've read this book. Now, I have to apologise for my talk because Luke was supposed to be doing a talk on Thursday and I've had a couple of days to prepare it, and normally I would do better than this. Normally it would have tech, but in 2 days I'm not going to touch tech and because something will go wrong. If you haven't read this book, Witness by Ariel Berger, B-U-R-G-E-R if you're listening, and it's about Elie Wiesel. I'll give you a little kind of potted thing. Some of you would be interested that actually Parker J. Palmer, who's also someone that people talk about at church, recommended this book also. The world remembers Elie Wiesel, Nobel laureate, activist and author of more than 40 books, including Night, as a great humanist. He died in July 2016. And Ariel Berger met him at 15 and they studied and taught together, and they had these classes that they ran on matters of intellect, spirituality, faith, and it's also about Berger's own journey, which I'm not going to go so much into, and as a fact that he was an assistant, a teaching assistant to Wiesel at Boston University. And so it gives you this front row seat because every day he would listen to what Elie Wiesel's classes were about, and he'd run off and write them down. And so you get this really kind of person sitting at the feet of someone very wise. And I apologise that I'm going to be kind of going a bit fast. I can see the clock, so I should have enough time. It's very hopeful. It's a sad book. It's a beautiful book. It's all over the place. They cover everything. And so I think it's a good book for young people to read. My son is into philosophy and I think this has a lot of good philosophy in it. They cover all the philosophy. They cover all the Greek gods, Buddhists, Muslim stuff, Christian stuff. They themselves are Hasidic Jews, but they don't leave any stone unturned. So if I sound a bit like I'm all over the place, they are all over the place. So I'm sorry for that. I would also like to just read a little bit, because Elie Wiesel wrote a book called Night, and it's about his experience as a Holocaust survivor. And this is what he writes about being in the camps. And from within me, I heard a voice answer, "Where is he? Hanging here in this gallows. Never shall I forget that night, that first night in camp that turned my life into one long night, seven times sealed. Never shall I forget that smoke. Never shall I forget the small faces of children whose bodies I saw transformed into smoke under a silent sky. Never shall I forget those flames that consume my faith forever. Never shall I forget the nocturnal silence that deprived me for all of eternity for the will to live." Now, it does get more cheerful than this. Don't feel. But you need to know this is what informs what he's saying. "Never shall I forget the moments that murdered my God and my soul and turned my dreams to ashes. Never shall I forget those things, even were I condemned to live as God, long as God himself." Never. So you've got to remember that's what informed Wiesel. When he did these talks, he never talked about Night. He never talked about his own experiences. He had a very interesting point of view on things. And what he was interested in was being a witness to oppression. And so he would travel to Cambodia, Bosnia, Moscow, South Africa, anywhere where there was oppression, he was there. And he said, "I am there to bear witness that victims are not alone, even if I can't change the situation." And if you don't listen to much of this and you don't get much of it, the thing I would like to take you to take from this is that every crucifixion deserves a witness. Can't change the crucifixion, but it deserves a witness. And so Ariel Berger, as his TA, would write down this stuff. So on Monday and Tuesday, they'd teach these classes. Monday would be broad philosophy, so they would do all the great philosophers. And on Tuesday, they would do more spiritual stuff. They would do stuff in relation to religious texts. And Elie Wiesel would always say, let me begin with your questions. So even though he was the wise one that everybody was coming to see, and this was the most audited class at Boston University, you know, the tradition of auditing classes where people just turn up to listen to different lectures, this class was always full of everybody. It was the most random class in terms of who turned up and who listened. And Elie Wiesel would say, listening to witness makes you a witness. And he believed in the power of education to change people morally, even in spite of what he knew about Weimar Germany. You know, that people were educated, urbane, advanced, well-read, professing humanistic values, artistic, you know. I'm just watching Babylon Berlin and all the beautiful clothes and the wonderful design and all this stuff was happening, and at the same point the world was turning fascist. You know, and his question was, how can we have knowledge as a blessing and not as a curse? And his whole life was about educating knowledge as a blessing and getting people talking about stuff rather than thinking it in their heads and going through it. And he said to this guy who had come from Rwanda, it's a country in Africa, but he said in class, I told you in class you must tell your story. You have made your memories a blessing. We must not turn our suffering into a bridge that others may suffer less. But as a therapist, I would also say don't make people tell their stories just to make other people feel better. And there's some people who shouldn't tell their stories because it makes their bodies feel worse and their heads feel worse. But for Elie Wiesel, he wasn't actually telling his story, but he wanted to tell other people, I'm a witness to your suffering, I'll listen. He also felt that Job spoke a lot to his experience, so the story of Job was very much his story, and he would often talk about that on Tuesdays. He was interested in the prophets, and we've got a million prophets that we could talk about, but I haven't got time. But if you're interested, you can look at some of that. He was also very interested in literature, and he would talk through a lot of the literature. He'd go through Dostoevsky, he'd go through Tolstoy, he'd go through poets, he'd go through many people. And one of the people he chose the play, and one of the things he was interested in was Waiting for Godot, which is basically a play that's an exercise in kind of futility, but it's not futility because people are waiting for something. He also spoke about St. Joan, which is a play by George Bernard Shaw. And he said that seeing and speaking some truths will make you be seen to be mad. And then he said, then madness must be an act of faith. So in a sense, we have to be holy fools sometimes, thinking, people think I'm nuts, but I still have to say this stuff. I can't be silent. And he said, sometimes we will not see things change, but we will be there to bear witness. And he's just interested in that liminal space, that space where you can't change things, where you are sitting there. And that witnesses will say, we've watched your suffering, we've watched your illness, we've watched your sadness, and we will record it. We will keep you in our memory. And because you have this memory, then things began to change. He also used to say, I'm not a judge, I'm just a witness. And that's a really challenging statement. I could talk for hours on that as well. And I'm not. I'm just throwing you all this stuff and you can catch some of it. He was also interested in where you get beyond words, because he was a word man and he knew all his words, but some things there aren't any words for. So he talked, one of his things were, how can you sing? How can you not sing in the face of this stuff? And I was also thinking about, as he was, about different artists, you know, like Manet, Goya, Picasso. I'm not a fan of Picasso, by the way. I haven't been for a long time. He's not very nice to people. But anybody who's been in a room with Guernica, if you've ever been in a room with it, it's a testament to what happened in a little village in fascist Spain. So can't stand Picasso, but he made this testament that, you know, and he never, in his whole history, never let that painting go back to Spain till it didn't have, till it had a new leader. So it lived in New York. He wouldn't send it back to Spain until Spain was out of that fascist kind of system. So I'll give him that. That's about all I'll give him. And I was also thinking about Rachmaninoff and the Second Symphony. I don't know if any of you have heard that, but that's a testament to the suffering of the Russian people at certain times. You don't need any words for that. You just listen to that, and you're there in that space and in that time. I'm also thinking of Chagall. I went to Reims Cathedral, and in Reims Cathedral they have a huge Chagall stained window. And in the morning, the light shines through Jesus smiling at you from the cross. And this is a Jewish man who made this beautiful thing that talks to me in a cathedral and probably talks to lots of people who aren't Christian in a cathedral without words. They bear witness in a way to things. There's also places that hold witness, places where there aren't words anymore, 7 times 7 or whatever. And you probably can think of places like Auschwitz, Culloden in Scotland. If you go to those places, you can feel something screaming to the sky. And you can also feel the still space where something is saying, remember this, bear witness to it. And I would also put in there Aboriginal massacre sites as well, or any massacre sites. Sometimes we have to say the unsayable, but sometimes other things say it for us. So that was one thing I found particularly interesting that he said. He also talked about otherness, and it's very complicated what he was saying, but he believed that, he said that we would, you know, how we make someone the other, and by making someone the other, you can say, well, they're those kind of people, so we can hurt them, we can treat them differently, we can do bad things to them because they're not us. And he would talk a lot about that. And he'd get lots of people saying, there's a lot of arguments in this book. There's a lots of things that some people won't agree with and other people will agree with. And there's people who come in and say outrageous things in his lectures. And his point was, I respect you, but I don't agree with you. But I will offer you respect. But I will also offer you my honesty. And in these times, I think that's an interesting thing to do. Offer someone respect, listen to someone, but you still may have opposition, you still may want to stop something, you may still want to protest. There are different worldviews, and you can listen, and there can be an interreligious dialogue, there can be interpolitical dialogues, there can be interpersonal dialogues. And sometimes people read witness in different ways, but I'm very interested in that idea of giving people the respect to be heard, but also offering honesty as part of that process. And that's what Elie Wiesel did. People said all these things and people would say, you know, they'd be saying, oh, they can't say that, they can't. He'd be like, you know, we have to hear this because it has to be out there in the open, you know, before you can disagree with it. If people are just sitting thinking that stuff without someone talking to them about it or listening to them and listening where that comes from in the heart of themselves. And I also resonate with the fact that often we try to change people's minds with logic. We try and say, these are the facts about global warming, you know. And really, people are saying, I need you to speak to my heart. I need you to be a witness not to the logic of things, but to the heart of things. And sometimes, instead of speaking to the adult, speaking to the little child who needs to be heard. Yeah. He has some problem. He's very big on the power of storytelling, so he uses a lot of stories. He uses all the stories and all the philosophies and all the religious traditions. He goes the Baal Shem Tov from his own tradition, all sorts of people. And he tells these stories because he's crossing cultures and he's bringing people together, because stories bring people together. And in a way, stories speak to that part of ourselves that's not always the logical part. It's a kid that likes to sit and listen to a story. And sometimes when I understand your story, I understand you. I'm bearing witness to your story. In the midst of Auschwitz, he prayed, and he said there was a tension at the heart of his faith. And he said, this tension about being in a place where things were so terrible. It's a necessity. He said the absurdity of faith is only matched by the necessity of faith. So it's completely surreal, and yet it's absolutely necessary. And I was thinking about a quote from C.S. Lewis. And if you've seen Shadowlands, you've heard this quote. And again, I think Alyssa was talking about this this morning. I pray because I can't help myself. I pray because I'm helpless. I pray because the need flows out of me all the time, waking and sleeping. It doesn't change God. It changes me. And that was kind of, I really resonated with that. another concept that he talked about was faith with teeth, that actually that's the same faith that questions things, that listens, that respects people, but it's not just I'm loving and I'm going to put up with all this stuff and just, but that I actually have some teeth in there as well if I need to, because I'm going to need to question some of your stuff or come back to you with some honesty. So from that, I got into another little tangent. So this is my kind of resonation with some of the stuff from this book. And I'm just talking a bit about witness in our context. And again, we could talk about testaments, the New Testament, the Old Testament. They are people witnessing things. And whether that's in Greek or in another language or paraphrastic, or maybe, you know, the speaker last week was talking about how the Bible is used for all purposes and we can all take our context. And I'm aware there's historians in the room and they would have a lot to say about witness and who the witnesses are and whose stuff gets recorded and whose stuff doesn't get recorded. I was listening to Richard Rohr the other day and he said, we Catholics have only recently discovered the Bible. And I was thinking to myself, yeah, that's a bit true sometimes. But it's also, you know, I spent a long time reading the Bible and studying the Bible, and yeah, it's about reading that witness and understanding that witness and questioning that witness. There's also the concept of things like false witness, that there are witnesses you can't trust. And we've all seen court cases or seen things or heard things. And sometimes that's used, the very small amount of false witness there is, because I believe a lot of the time testimony is true in things, but that small amount of false witness will then cast aspersions on everything. People have an argument where they just go, well, that wasn't true, so all of it must not be true. You know. So it's an interesting concept to go through, and I haven't got time to do it in great detail. But I was very interested in witness in terms of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, because, you know, another bunch of people would have said, well, let's just all punish these people. Now, let's just all let rip, you know. But to actually have one person there who did something and another person there who it was done to, and for that person to say to that person, this is witness statements, this is a lot of things, for me to look at you and say, you did this to me, you need to witness how this affected me, how it affected my family, that's a very big way of telling a story and speaking heart to heart about something. I'm not saying it would solve problems, I'm not saying it would take away trauma, because that takes a lot more. But this kind of stuff is how we come to the heart of people, that we witness what happened to them. And again, perhaps we weren't able to change it, perhaps we won't, but we continue to be witnesses. Another concept that's interesting is living memory. They say that once living memory stops, people start to rejig history or say this didn't happen or whatever. Holocaust survivors are now getting very, you know, thin on the ground. And people are worried. And, even Aboriginal history, if you're talking about the stolen generation, we need to write these things down now. We need to have these witnesses. We need to have it. And not just so that's for a future thing, but just we need to hear it. And some people sometimes say to me, look, why are they preaching to the converted? Why do they keep telling this story over and over again? Because they need us to hear it. not necessarily to do anything about it all the time, but just to hear it, to say, yes, that happened. And I was at a meeting once where that happened. This child protection woman, she actually apologised to this bunch of Aboriginal people for... And they said, that's the first time anybody's apologised to us. And this, and they, you could see all their faces. And I thought, you can never tell when or where your listening and your witnessing might, you know, make someone's heart feel better. And again, from that, the Makarrata stuff that's happening at the moment, from the statement of the heart stuff, from the Aboriginal people who all gathered in Uluru to talk about what we're going to do about, you know, all the issues. I won't go into it too much, but basically Makarrata means a restoration of peace after dispute. So there's a lot of Aboriginal people at the moment trying to come to some consensus about how they want the constitution or treaty or whatever. But it's basically you have to come to a space where you're all talking together and there's some peace. And that requires a lot of listening. And it's actually a ceremonial ritual symbolising that stuff. That's what Makarrata actually means. And I heard one Aboriginal people say a lovely thing. It's by the way, it's a Yolnu word if you're interested in which Aboriginal language it is. One person said, you can't get to justice if you don't get to the truth. And I really like that. There's also many times where witness is a very small thing, and I was thinking about this. And I was thinking about funerals. I've been to a few lately, and I really appreciate people giving witness to the people they loved, who are still in their lives, who they still love, and to hear all the things I didn't know about them. And it's just such a profound, respectful thing to offer that witness, to offer that, yes, you lived in this world, you did these things, we loved you. And that's also about the people that are alive, and I think about in terms of people who are sick and people have to sit with them and bear witness to that. Or people in families, or people in communities, people who are disabled, people who have, you know, all sorts of things going on, and they bear witness to those things, and sometimes they can't change them. But they sit there and they are with those people. It's a profound thing. And I was listening to this lovely painter, and she's older now, and she does these amazing paintings. She's American. I've lost her name for now because I've got all these things written down and some of them get lost. But she's suffering from dementia and she's still painting, she's still involved with stuff. And all her friends say she's living in the now and she's living in a state of grace, like a saint. And I thought, imagine for all the sick people, all the people who need stuff, we saw them like saints. We saw them as living in a state of grace. In that liminal space, imagine we'd all go to see them. We'd all sit at their feet and say, you know, give us some of your grace. So that's something in terms of witness. Sometimes it's that liminal silent thing, but you're just holding someone's hand. You're just at the foot of the cross. And that actually leads me to a lovely, lovely statement by someone called Barbara at the Billy Kyle's Civil Rights Lecture. And this is what they said. We said that if they were going to crucify the poor, the sick, the children, the unemployed, the immigrants, the LGBT, and the women, and then voting rights, then every crucifixion deserves a witness. Now, we're at the time of Easter, so that's kind of a thought I'd like you to carry in your head. Like, for you, where's the crucifixion that needs a witness? And again, we're watching situations that sometimes don't change, sometimes do change. Sometimes we can't be with, sometimes we can be with. But someone needs to be at the foot of the cross watching that happen. And sometimes, I think like in cases like where there's doctors or where there's nurses or we've got to keep an eye on a little kid who's in danger, being a witness is a bit of this. It's a bit of, I'm looking at you and I see what you're doing. So I'm watching how you're treating these people. So don't think you can get away with hurting them just because they're disabled or they're little children or they're whatever, or they're sick or they're old. But sometimes being the witness is a bit of that too. And one of the statements that Paula Gunn Allen said was that the root of oppression is the loss of memory. So we all carry all sorts of memories and all sorts of witness, and it's in our heart. Now, I'm aware as I say all this stuff, it's all over the place. So I'm just throwing it out there like bird seed. And you can eat it or you cannot eat it. It can grow on the ground. I'm okay. I realise it's a bit random. I think a lot about my own witness because I worked a lot with refugees and in welfare and domestic violence. And the one thing I have about people that I worked with is their courage, the courage and generosity of people who survive bad stuff. And that's a liminal space and it's worth being in sometimes. And I think a lot of it's about listening. I'm a chatty person, but I know how to shut up. And listening is not preaching, it's not proselytising, it's not bringing the good news to the poor sometimes in the sense of, you know, well, I want to tell you what a good person I am and, you know, how fantastic I am, but it's about them, it's about listening to them. And I think we need to listen before we preach. And when you hear the stuff, then you can reflect that back to people in the way they need to hear it. Just one last thing, because it's kind of... I was thinking about my work, and I did suffer some secondary traumatic stress from working for such a long time with such difficult things, and I had to keep looking after myself in that process. I'm not saying you should go out there and do it eternally. You need to look after yourselves. But I used to talk to my colleague, the two of us. We would speak together. We'd chat all the time. And we'd try to make sense of things after we, you know, because at one point I think we saw, you know, all the people from Srebrenica that came to the Osborne Park flats. We were speaking to them every day, you know, and it was our workplace, it was everything. And we were just, we were pretty bereft. And I would sit with my colleague at 6 o'clock at night and I'd say, you know, what do I do? And she's kind of a bit of a Buddhist. And she said, well, there's darkness in the world and there's light in the world. That's not changing. She said, I used to be in a world where I thought, if I get up there and I stand and I have all my banners and I do all my stuff, I will make it all light. I will change the world and it will all be done. And then she said, there's always darkness. There's always light. And you choose a side. And you work on that side. But you're also going, I might not be able to get all of that done. But being a witness, I think it's about also looking after yourself as a witness and caring for yourself as a witness. So I'm sorry if this is kind of a bit random and a bit all over the place, but that was my reflections. That's what this book led me to do. So I recommend Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom, Witness by Ariel Berger. And I would also just recommend that you figure out what crucifixion that you're a witness to. And thank you very much.
One or two very quick comments or questions. I'll be super quick.
I didn't get to do Europe, yep. So some of those references to great works of art, could you please email us what they were? I don't know which cathedral the
Shigal is in. I would have normally done the
tech,
but because I had so little time to prayer, I would have had the pictures for you. But
yes,
yeah.
Oh, I understand, absolutely. Yeah. But yeah. If you just gave us a list, we can search them ourselves.
Okay, well, even if I just say it for now, Goya, it's on the recording, Las Meninas, Guernica by Picasso, and I'm just trying to remember, there was another reference there which... That's Reims Cathedral, spelled R-E-I-M-S, and that's Marc Chagall. And Manet, it's the picture of the shooting in Mexico, but I can't remember what the title is. But they were recording stuff, so you thought about it. Yep.
just a reflection, I guess, when you're talking about false witness, that we are all, and it kind of touches on what you're talking about, taking care of yourself, is that we are all capable of bearing false witness.
Yes, yes.
What we bring to a situation in terms of our sense of entitlement and what we're expecting can result in us bearing false witness.
Yep, yep.
And we actually need to be mindful of what we're bringing before we start that.
Yep, yep.
One thing for me in Europe that really resonated with me was the underground monument of the empty bookcases on the site where the books were burnt.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jen.
So thank you.